The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Say my piece and then we'll take questions. All right, well, so this is supposed to be the session on advising on choices in administrative law and constitutional law. One of the things to think about as you're picking for the fall, and I know this may not seem like a great boon, but it's taken years to have it happen, is that I think in the next week or 10 days, the registrar is actually going to put out a tentative schedule for spring 2013. That's never happened before. And you would think it would happen routinely, but it doesn't. And so you actually, as you're looking at the fall courses, could also be thinking about spring courses and sort of balancing your selections. If, now having said that, and it turns out not to be true, if you don't get to see the spring schedule before you have to register, it's usually pretty much the same from year to year. If you're looking for particular areas of interest, you could look at the current spring schedule and more or less extrapolate that the same offerings will be there next spring as well. So just for planning purposes, that might help. I guess most faculty would say you should, in law school, do a combination of courses that you have to take, courses that most people take because they're important and worthwhile, and then courses that you may be interested in for various reasons. They may be intellectually challenging. They may help you identify areas of practice that you might be interested in. They might just sound cool. And you know, I think some of them are bar courses, some of them are not bar courses. I think we would all kind of suggest that you take a mix of those things. Most faculty that I've heard talk about this would say, don't take everything that you think is a bar-related course. You don't need to do that. You can get a fair amount from bar review classes at the end of law school, and you'd be cheating yourself out of the opportunity to take things that you're really interested in. Having said that, do you want to do an introduction, and then we can talk about specifics?
Yeah. So what I almost always say is exactly what Professor Ramil just said, except I say in parentheses, accept evidence, take evidence. It just makes sense to take it. It's such a interesting, important, central subject. It's such an important part of the bar, and it's necessary for clinic. So I believe that that's the case. So I'm not going to tell you you're nuts if you don't take evidence, but you know, I highly suggest it.
Most of the clinics either require evidence or there are one or two for which evidence is a co-requisite. You could be taking it at the same time. But the reality is you're not going to get as much out of the clinic experience if you're taking evidence at the same time.
And when I say that it's an important part of the bar, the way the bar is structured is, as some of you may already know, there is basically one day in most states of multiple choice questions and one day of essay questions. And the one-day multiple choice questions is called the multi-state because it's the same around the country. And there are six subjects that are covered in that. And five of them are required classes, and the sixth is evidence. I'm not telling you to take a class that isn't interesting. Evidence is actually fascinating. But there's all kinds of reasons to take it. I guess as an introduction, I would say my area of specialty is food and drug regulation. I have thoughts about food and drug regulation in particular and administrative law, regulatory law in general. One puzzle, one question that I've never been able to really answer is whether it makes more sense to take administrative law before taking any specific area of administrative law, like food and drug or environmental or oil and gas or whatever, or whether actually it makes more sense to take a specific area of administrative law before you take administrative law, the class called administrative law. There are benefits both ways. The one thing I will say is that when I was in law school and I took administrative law, I found the entire subject almost sort of outside my real deep understanding, because I didn't really hadn't internalized what the administrative state is all about, what administrative agencies do on a day-to-day basis. There was something abstract about it for me, not having ever experienced either through a job or through a class the operations of a particular agency. So I think that there is that benefit to taking a particular administrative law class before taking administrative law. But that said, I don't feel powerful about it one way or the other. How many of you took an elective this year in administrative law? Any of you? Okay. So for you, the question is answered. You've taken administrative law. How many of you have taken either environmental or food and drug? So for you, the question is answered. But for the rest of you, I don't think it's a huge deal one way or the other. But it's worth thinking about.
You may be assuming knowledge that isn't present, so let's back up one step. Administrative law is the study of the Administrative Procedure Act and sort of the rules and processes that govern 100 different federal agencies. I mean, the entire alphabet soup of the federal government, the SEC, the FEC, the FCC, the NLRB, the CFTC, all of those agencies are governed by the same set of procedures for how they make rules, for how they decide cases, and so on. That's administrative law. Then each separate agency, like the Food and Drug Administration, has its own separate set of substantive law, which that agency enforces and implements. And that's what you would get in food and drug law, or communications law, or labor law, or pick a subject, environmental law, oil and gas law. Every one of those is sort of a separate substantive subject with its own body of statutes. But they're all governed by the Administrative Procedure Act, which you study in administrative law.
Well put.
Well, let me say a couple of words about con law related stuff, and then we can sort of open it up, I guess, or see what's on everybody's minds. I mean, you know, since you're all taking con law, that we don't really cover First Amendment in the constitutional law classes. There is a separate 3-credit class in First Amendment. It's being offered once in the fall, and I think maybe twice in the spring. I'm going to teach it at night in the spring, and somebody else is going to teach a day section in the spring. There are a variety of civil rights related classes that sort of relate to con law or build on con law. If those interest you, we can talk about that. Legal history, which Professor Grossman also teaches, is con law related and can be a nice add-on to con law. I guess there are a variety of other things that we can talk about specifics. Some offered in the spring. There's usually legislation classes, although I think there may be going to be offered in the spring, which relate to how the legislative process works and legislative drafting and so on. There's no real sequence of classes you have to do for con law. Con law is not something that most people choose to go into as a specialty because, frankly, it's hard to make a living doing con law. There are lots of con law cases out there at which people make a living, but they tend to be more established lawyers or people working in nonprofits.
I mean, no matter what kind of law.
Agencies.
I mean, no matter what kind of law you practice. I shouldn't say no matter what kind of law you practice, but most kinds of law you practice, you might well have constitutional issues. But there is a vanishingly small number of people who go out into the world and say, "I am a constitutional lawyer." Administrative law is different, by the way. There is a huge body of lawyers in Washington, D.C., who are administrative lawyers. Many people, when they come to law school, tend to think of lawyers as litigators, civil and or criminal. Sometimes people also have the notion of lawyers as transactional lawyers helping with corporate transactions and mergers and acquisitions and all that kind of stuff. Some people might even have a vision of a lawyer as somebody who writes wills and advises people in trusts and estates. But the one thing that most people don't have in their vision of a lawyer when they come to law school is something that you are very, very well positioned to take advantage of, given the strengths of this school and its location, which is to pursue a career as an administrative lawyer, which can be in the agencies, in a law firm, in a trade association, in a public interest organization, on the Hill. And basically, if you're acting as a lawyer, a private lawyer, just to take an example, in administrative law, what you're doing is you are serving as a guide for industries and other clients through the very complex regulatory maze that they must negotiate in order to conduct their day-to-day lives in business. So it's largely advisory. It's also advocacy, because you are oftentimes advocating for your client in front of the agency, and also sometimes advocating that the agency itself change the relevant rules through advocacy documents. You often do that. It is a non-combative type of practice, which always appealed to me. If you don't feel like being sort of fighting about stuff all the time, a lot of times you just feel like you're helping people. It is, like any other Washington law practice, sometimes hysterically busy and ridiculous, but I would say that in general it is less so than litigation and corporate transactional work. It's more kind of steady as she goes, less travel. And finally, it is just utterly fascinating. You feel like you're at the center of activity that ends up on the front page of the New York Times and Wall Street Journal and Washington Post all the time. So as you choose your classes, remember that that's a whole career option for you that you may or may not have considered after first year.
And it's much of what government lawyers do. It's not just government lawyers, as Professor Grossman said, but if you picture, you've all been talking about the arguments in the healthcare cases. Those arguments all focused on the constitutional issues. But meanwhile, there are dozens and dozens and dozens of lawyers at the Department of Health and Human Services writing regulations to implement various parts of the healthcare law. Those lawyers are engaged in the practice of administrative law. Some of those regulations will be challenged. There'll be fights under the Administrative Procedure Act about whether those rules were properly issued and whether they were, you know, promulgated on based on the right amount of evidence and material by the agency and so on. All of that is the practice of administrative law.
I mean, if you want to get into the, to me, very attractive revolving door of Washington law practice, and I say attractive in the sense of you don't have to make decisions early in your life about where you'll be the rest of your life. Administrative lawyers can benefit from that as much or more than any other kind of lawyer. This year in the agency, the next year on a commission, the year after that in a private law firm, the year after that working at a public interest organization. It is a very, very exciting life, and a very Washington life.
You learn a huge amount about how government works,
yeah.
Not just in your own niche, but much more broadly.
And there is state administrative law, by the way, so to the extent that you learn about administrative procedure at the federal level, that will certainly be relevant if you end up working in state government as well.
All right, well, I'm sure we could keep going for hours, but why don't we see if there are questions. If there aren't, we'll keep talking, but do you have particular things on your minds that you want to ask about? Particular courses, particular career paths, particular fields?
Even feel free to ask us questions about things that have nothing to do with administrative law or constitutional law.
I'm just really quick, I know a few of us have to go to class, but aside from other just basic core courses for somebody that is interested in government, whether it's legislation or working in politics or anything like that, that you really need to have under your belt?
I wouldn't say you have to, but I think that a course in legislation is very, very useful, and we happen to have a wonderful, wonderful professor who teaches that, Amanda Frost. I don't know if she's the only one who's teaching it these days.
We don't actually have a regular legislation class on the fall schedule. It definitely will be offered in the spring.
The other one is federal courts. So federal courts is a very, very exciting and very, very complex course, which overlaps in many ways with administrative law in terms of the overall structure of government and how to vindicate your rights within it and the role of courts within the overall governmental structure. So employers really like seeing that class on a transcript, I would say. I mean, I say employers. Obviously, if you're going to go to, you know, Sullivan and Cromwell and do, you know, draft documents for, initial public offerings, they're not going to care as much. But for either litigation or for a life as an administrative lawyer, I think federal courts is a great class, and we are again blessed with a couple of over the top excellent federal courts teachers. Who's teaching it in the fall?
Flattick. I mean, I would describe federal courts as a combination between advanced constitutional law and advanced civil procedure for the federal courts. And together, that's a critical combination, particularly if you're going to ever do any federal court litigation.
And there are certain subjects that are essential to administrative lawyers that you might really address in detail only in federal courts, namely all the justiciability doctrines concerning, do you have standing to challenge government action? Do you have, is it ripe? Is it moot? All those types of things could have ended up in various places in the law school curriculum, and they happen to land in, sometimes in administrative law, sometimes in federal courts.
Is admin law a true prereq for any of the other classes? And would you recommend taking election law during the election or after the election when you get
that? I don't see that we actually have a basic election law class in the fall. I know that we have a class called Law of the American Political Process, and I think it's being offered in the spring. I'm pretty sure it's being offered this semester. I don't see a basic election law class on the schedule for the fall. I'll put in one quick commercial plug, which I made earlier, which is I run this two-week summer program called the Summer Institute on Law and Government. And it's a collection of three-hour lectures on 31 different subjects. Four of those lectures are on election law. And if you take those four, that's one credit. There's one on campaign finance. There's one on voting redistricting. There's one on denying voters access to the ballot in the polling place. And there's another one on gerrymandering. And those four together, it's the first week of the Institute, which is June 18th to June 22nd. It's four mornings, June 18th to June 21st. It's four three-hour lectures, just one week. That's one credit.
And Elliot,
I'm not saying that's a substitute for an election law class, but since we don't have an election law class in the fall, I'm just mentioning that that's a possibility to think about.
And I don't know whether administrative law is a prerequisite for any class in the entire catalog. It's certainly not a prerequisite for any that I can think of. There might be some kind of seminar, advanced seminar, that I'm not familiar with. But again, you know, as I was suggesting, you can sort of structure your exploration of the administrative state in any order you want to, I would say.
I mean, if you find out next Saturday that you got onto the Administrative Law Review, that might be a reason for taking administrative law sooner rather than later.
What's the fluidity between doing just being an administrative attorney versus perhaps doing litigation for the government? And if there is, you know, reasonable fluidity, what can, what, how should we, you know, plan to do or explore that option?
Well, I certainly did not mean to suggest that administrative lawyers don't do litigation. I think that it varies person by person. There are some environmental lawyers, for example, who are almost only litigators. So there's a range within it. There are some who kind of have a foot in both worlds. But you can also choose to have a life as an administrative lawyer where you're just not litigating at all, and there's litigators that you're working with either inside or outside the government. Whether you're inside or outside the government, there are other people who specialize in actually litigating in administrative problems. That said, if you're interested in litigation and interested in administrative law, there are lots of people in this city and, in fact, around the country who make their living litigating cases, either defending people who have had charges, criminal or otherwise, brought against them by the government in administrative context, or suing the government based on its conduct in various ways in the in administration. So by all means, don't think you're choosing a non-litigation path, and go ahead and take federal jurisdiction and litigation classes and all that kind of stuff as part of your package, if that's how you see yourself.
There's also a separate body of people, smaller, that are interested in administrative law for its own sake, that it's its own sort of system of governance of the federal bureaucracy. So one of our colleagues, Jeff Lubbers, who's teaching administrative law in the fall, works with an entity called the Administrative Conference of the United States, which sort of studies the administrative law and administrative process to make sure it's working properly and working efficiently, to make sure that rules are being issued properly and all that, you know, kind of aspect of it.
Well, I'm teaching an advanced food and drug law class for the first time next spring, and I haven't figured out exactly what it's going to look like, but it may be a little bit more skills-based in the sense of actually engaging in at least oral advocacy. I'm not positive about that. I don't know that we have a class in, like, rule drafting or something like that, but I also think that the general ethos of the way that many people teach their classes in specific substantive areas is one of taking into account the practitioner's mindset. And so I wouldn't say there's any drafting classes that I know of, but there are certainly many where instead of living up in the ether in some conceptual level, you're looking at actual rules and regulations and comments and things like that.
I guess the only thing I would add to that is we do have a disability rights clinic, and that clinic sometimes deals with special ed clients, and those clients may be involved in either federal or local administrative proceedings. It may be they may be litigating or administrative proceedings with the D.C. government, for example. So that could give you some administrative practical experience.
And lots of people do externships in administrative agencies. This is Professor Vladek, for those of you who don't know him, who I think I described in his absence as a gifted teacher.
Just a late teacher who's classwork late.
Yeah. But I'll also add that from a, you know, in this obviously very, for some people, scary job environment, that I think from my experience that for people especially who are trying to get jobs in the government, that having taken not just administrative law, but a class in the particular administrative area that you're trying to get a job in, is a huge advantage in the job market. So like in the past few years, I've had a student go and work at the chief counsel's office at FDA. Another one just got a job at a boutique food and drug law firm. And there's someone else who I'm consulting with now. And none of them would have gotten those jobs unless they'd taken food and drug law. And the comparative advantage is quite great there because not that many students around the country do take food and drug law. But even if, you know, if you want to go work for the EPA, you know, it's effectively required, in my mind, that you take environmental law, both to know whether you actually like it, because a lot of people think they're going to go and, like, be saving owls or something, and then they have to do CERCLA and RCRA and, you know, all that kind of stuff.
What's wrong with CERCLA?
CERCLA is wonderful. I'm just saying it's not about owls.
So I would just add one other thought to that, too, owls. Which is if all of this is Greek to you and you have no clue what the agencies are and what they do and how you would possibly figure out what you were interested in. I wouldn't say this is a strong recommendation, but we have a summer school class in the regular 9-week summer school program called Federal Regulatory Process. It's co-taught by 3 former agency lawyers. I guess one is still an agency lawyer and the other 2 are former. And it's a 9-week summer school class, and what they do is they cover a different agency each week, and they actually bring in a guest speaker from each federal agency that they're covering. So over the course of the 9 weeks, you might learn about some part of the Transportation Department, some part of the Environmental Protection Agency, and some part of the Federal Aviation Administration, and so on. And, it, you know, it's not a bad introduction to sort of what the different agencies do. It's not going to cover every agency. And the risk is you might think you're interested in one particular one and then find yourself in the class and they're not covering that one. But otherwise, it's not a bad way to kind of get a sense of what they do.
I had a class running before, so you might have asked this question already, but some of these topics of class that we've taken in the fall are electives that we're currently taking. Are those the same exact courses?
So, for example, administrative law?
Yeah, for
instance. Yeah, so I assume that I don't know if they're exactly the same. In some instances, they are for fewer credits. But they certainly, I don't want to make any representations that I don't have a basis for, but I'm fairly confident that if you take administrative law as a first-year elective, you're not allowed to take the class called administrative law in the upper level. I know that if you take food and drug law as a first-year elective, you're not allowed to take food and drug law 1, you know, the basic food and drug as a at the upper level, and it's certainly true for environmental law, in especially since the environmental law elective is 3 credits first year.
You guys were so energetic and happy. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You're overwhelmed by having to pick pleasant.
Well, it's overwhelming.
So what else can we do to help?
Going back to that summer institute that you were talking about, for the full, like you said it was 2 credits, is it writing a paper?
It's one credit. The election law part is 1 credit.
Is that writing a paper or is that an exam?
There's a short take-home essay question for each of the 4 classes. I mean, you basically, the total of the 4 would be about 3,000 words.
How about this for a piece of advice? More of you than you think would love tax. I'll say that. It's actually a great, great class, and it sort of is interesting in and of itself, but also gives you a great basis for discussing big policy issues, and it's the IRS itself is a government agency, and so it's a look at how one particular agency throws its weight around.
And just to echo a theme you started already, and we're blessed with very, very good tax professors.
I don't know if you guys talked about this, but I think, you know, even for folks who are interested in public law and government regulation, I think there's a lot to be said for what are called the code classes, right? So bankruptcy might not seem like something you guys are interested in. It's actually a really neat topic to think about how, like, we construct our legal system to deal with a problem like bankruptcy. There's really cool stuff in there about social policy, about the role of the federal courts about the, you know, the reallocation of resources between parties. I mean, you know, I'm not trying to say you should go out and become bankruptcy lawyers, but insofar as diversifying your exposure and trying something new, you know, classes about sort of contained bodies of law, like tax, like bankruptcy, like securities regulation, are things that you tend not to jump at when you're in your position, but I wouldn't sort of, you know, ignore them. I've had a number of students who were surprised by just how much they enjoyed those courses and how much they got out of them, even if they didn't get out, like, a long-term professional trajectory.
And I have a friend who, an ex-student, now friend, who I had to convince to take tax. She's like, tax, and she took tax, and now she's a tax lawyer at Skadden Arps and spending her entire life as a tax lawyer. So you never know.
So what else do you want us to talk about? You want us to talk about things you should take? Would that be helpful?
Should take? Shouldn't take?
Should take or shouldn't take? Well, we can't talk about things you shouldn't take.
Well, what kinds of questions do you guys have? General questions about general things about WCL, if not specific classes?
Do you have any advice for if you're really low on the TOEFL?
Be patient. I think, you know, a lot of the classes that you probably have as your top choices will fill up. Don't assume that if there's a waiting list, you won't get off of it. I mean, I told my 1Ls this. You know, some of you guys are here. I've had students get off the waiting list, for example, from a federal course class who at one point were 57th on the waiting list. So don't take, you know, waiting list as like a death sentence for that class. Obviously, you should have other options, but don't like assume that if it's full in registration, you won't get in. A lot of things happen. A lot of things change. You know, be flexible. Obviously, you know, don't sort of say there are only four classes I want to take, and if I don't get those four, I'm going to, you know, commit harakiri. But I think, you know, be patient, right? I mean, a lot of classes open up during registration that had a wait list. And so don't assume that just because it looks closed at this point that you'll never get it. Now, if it's a 12-person seminar, if the waiting list has 75 people on it, you know, I think that's a longer shot. But for bigger classes especially, do not assume the wait list means you won't get in.
In fact, there's only a rough correlation between the list of people who are in the class at the end of registration and the list of people who end up actually taking the class.
Exactly right.
Much to our frustration.
So I just say, I mean, like, hang in there. You know, the other piece of this is the registrar isn't always sort of, we're not always as upfront about this as we could be. You know, the waiting list policy, just because it's sort of, you're not in a class by the time the waiting list process closes during registration doesn't mean you can't get in afterwards, right? So, you know, if there's a class you really want to take and you feel like you're close, talk to the professor. You know, don't give up just because it says there's a waiting list. You know, just sort of, but you know, again, be realistic about what classes those are.
Elliot?
It's might be more of a night student question, but just practically balancing your schedule. Is it smarter to do like 2 4s and a 2 or 4 2 3s?
I think it depends on what the classes are more than the specific credit load. I mean, not all four, you guys have already learned this, right? Not all four credit classes are alike insofar as workload is concerned. Not all three credit courses are alike. So I don't really think you can make a generalization about 2 4s and a 3 versus a 4 2 3s. I think it has to be a much more specific calculation based on whether it's a heavy 4, a light 3, you know, things like that. I mean, I think.
Paper or exam.
You know, I think. You know, all the credit hour tells you for sure is how many hours a week you're going to spend in class. And even that isn't necessarily true. I mean, you know, my 4-credit common law class meets for closer to 5 credits, if you guys haven't noticed. Right? So, you know, I think, you know, I wouldn't worry about that so much as paper versus exam, heavy reading, light reading, you know, asshole professor, you know, one of these two.
We do know that courses taught by Vladek have more reading than courses taught by other people.
That's what I was saying. I'll freely admit that. I don't think anyone in this room who has me right now is going to dispute that. Right? Yeah, I see you guys sitting in the back nodding a little.
I mean, the other part of balancing is how many kind of super rules-intensive classes are you taking and do you want to mix? I mean, evidence is very rules intensive. That might suggest not taking, you know, something else that's also 4 credits and also extremely rules focused. Save that for another semester or something. I don't know.
And
if you guys agree with that.
But. Another observation is that if you are planning on trying to apply for a paid summer job for next summer, then you're actually going to be applying in the fall. If you're talking about law firms and some agencies that have summer associate programs and so forth. So you will have your fall transcript, not your grades, but your fall transcript to show them, like, what are you taking? So if there's any true law and banana classes that you want to take, by law and banana, I mean just, like, you know, curiosities that you find fascinating but aren't necessarily career-oriented, maybe you should wait until after first semester, second year, to do so. Yeah?
I said, do a lot of these agencies that, you know, they want to SEC, obviously, do they have those paid summer positions for 2Ls, or do they rising 3Ls, or do they seem like they're still always on paid?
Well, I know that the Food and Drug Administration, the chief counsel's office, started a paid summer associate program last year. I can't speak for other agencies. Because it's paid, it's incredibly competitive, but it's there, and they're proud of it. And I don't know whether it's – have you guys heard of other agencies that have paid summer associate programs?
Does the FCC have some?
Yeah.
Paid summers too.
But even if it's not paid, maybe I should back up. Regardless whether it's paid or not, a first summer job can be a very rich and fulfilling experience and a stepping stone on the way to further employment. So certainly there's all kinds of jobs at the agencies for first years, whether or not they're paid jobs. And I assume that they're competitive also, even if they're unpaid.
So, kind of hear this every once in a while with 2L, 3L students. There's always a balance between externships and classes. So some students will do, like in DC, internships and externships during the school year. Do you have any recommendations about balancing those two? Like maybe you're doing too many externships in one situation as opposed to doing just strict classes. Is there a good sort of rule of thumb for when you know you're not doing what you should be doing, aside from taking the mandatory courses like evidence, Crim Pro, and legal ethics? I know evidence isn't necessary.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if there's a rule of thumb. I think it's great for people, particularly if you're not sure what you want to do, to use externships as a way to get experience in different fields, to, you know, do two widely different externships looking for something that really appeals to you. I mean, I think most faculty would probably say we find students paying less and less attention to classes second and third year because they're doing externships and journals and job applications and so on. But I think we sort of accept it. Is that fair?
Yeah, I mean, I see a bunch of students who I think are just overcommitted, too much of a good thing. I think you can diminish your experience of whatever you're doing if you just have too much on your plate. And when you add journals to the mix, I just sometimes wish that people would would do less and work harder at each thing that they're doing, less distracted. But that's not a rule of thumb. That's just a releasing you from thinking that the best path is always to do everything. While I think externships are great, if you don't do an externship and instead focus on classes, that's a perfectly respectable way to go through law school too. If you don't like classes, you know, and want to load up on externships and clinic, that's fine also. I just see too many people trying to do everything.
It comes from a good place. I mean, you know, it's an admirable quality, but I think, you know, it's something that you guys will all learn for yourselves how to balance.
I mean, part of it is just practical. Think about what your day and your week are going to look like. Actually sit down and map it out. You know, if you're going to get out of class at 11:50 and you're supposed to be downtown by 12:30 and you're going to work till 5:30 and you have a 6 o'clock class, that's going to be a pretty miserable, stressful way to do things. You're not going to be getting a whole lot of enjoyment out of anything you're doing on that day.
you know, maybe that's the way to make the decision. How much can you pack in and still feel good about what you're doing?
You know, I do see students, by the way, who, because of their other commitments, kind of don't take the class all that seriously over the course of the semester and then try to do this major cram job, you know, for the exam and may hurt themselves grade-wise. I mean, I think that another thing you should make sure you're doing is keeping your grades up. And if you feel like your grades are suffering from overcommitment, that's a good reason not to overcommit.
You don't want to ask us invidious questions about specific professors?
What do you answer?
Depends on who you ask about.
Ask and we'll see.
For tax or for business associations, for people who wouldn't think that they necessarily wanted to take those, not afraid of the workload, but just not of inherent interest, do you have recommendations for people who make those fundamental?
Sure.
Who's teaching tax in the fall?
I think
PMDs.
So in tax,
left,
you know, there's adjunct in the mix for
left,
for tax that I don't really know, but I know that both of the professors that are tenure track teaching tax, Benjamin Leff and Andy Pike, are very, very good.
Yeah, I think one's a little more gregarious and ebullient than the other, but I'll put it this way: I would take Professor Leff if I could.
And he is teaching federal personal income tax in the fall.
Monday, Wednesday, 11 to 1. Eesh, 11 to 1.
Pike is teaching federal corporate income tax, but I think generally
personal is a prerequisite.
You should do personal first.
Right? And
for BA,
again, pretty good lineup that is when I looked at BA the other day.
Excuse me, one second.
I mean, the only thing I can say based on sort of just hearsay is that Professor Siegel is fantastic and very rigorous. So if you're planning on half-assing the class, don't take Professor Siegel. But I haven't heard anything but good things about any of those teachers as classroom teachers.
I think Professor Anderson's a little more esoteric, right, which is not, I don't mean that as like a subtle dig. I actually just mean I think he's idiosyncratic, which I think some people really like, and I think some people don't. I really don't read anything into that.
Do you want me to turn off the tape before we start talking?
No. I think Ken would agree he's idiosyncratic.
No, I'm not talking about Ken in particular. I'm wondering whether...
No.
Okay.
the beauty of tenure, right? No, I mean, so I think, you know, you guys have access... I mean, you guys... I think you guys underutilize your access to old evaluations. You know... When we're talking about people who are tenure and tenure track, there are years of evaluations on them, and there are patterns that emerge that I think say a lot more about how well their classes are received than I ever could. But I think there are some good choices in both those classes.
Do you guys know how to access the evaluations?
No, I don't know.
Through my AU. It's not my WCL, it's my AU.
Well, actually, I think they changed it so you can now do it through my WCL.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But one way or the other, you can find them. And I will say that be a little bit more forgiving of newer professors who, like, maybe the first year they teach don't get great evaluations, and then, you know, maybe the second year only a little better, but third year they've found their footing. Those professors can be just great professors who have learned, you know, I had to learn how to teach. Some people are just, you know, naturals. Other people just, you know, get better for the first couple of years. But for long-standing professors, forgive them, you know, the one semester where they seem to have dropped. But there are a lot of really, really, really highly ranked professors at this school, and why not take them? You know, and as a matter of fact, I would shop professors more than I would shop subjects on the margin, because any professor can make any subject fascinating, and any professor can make any subject awful. So, professors are important.
And trust that your predecessors take the evaluations seriously, even if some of them don't, right? I mean, as I say, there's truth in large numbers. And so if someone's consistently getting low fours or high threes, that's a pretty big sign to stay away, I think. Because even for our forgiving students, that still strikes me as low.
But that said, even if you find yourself in a required or semi-required class with a professor whose evaluations are in the low fours, keep it in perspective, recognize that there were therefore a good chunk of people in that class who gave that professor fives, the highest possible rating, and so you might end up loving the class anyway. It's just all a matter of averages. I don't mean to suggest that your personal experience of a class is going to be defined by the statistical averages of evaluations.
Can you talk a little bit about what civil rights classes you might recommend taking?
Federal courts.
Depends on your definition of civil rights, but...
You agree, right?
We have a great adjunct who's been teaching here for years, who teaches a class called Civil Rights and Remedies.
Oh, Professor Gross.
Yeah.
Yes, well, it's 933-001, Tuesday night, 6:30 to 9:10.
He's a longtime Justice Department lawyer. As far as I know, the class has been very well, always well received.
Has he actually had the syllabus up?
So that's one. I mean, that'll go over a lot of basic civil rights statutes.
But I wasn't kidding. Federal courts also. Like, you know, to a degree you're trying to vindicate civil rights in federal courts, which is how you're often trying to do it. It's an absolutely foundational class for any civil rights lawyer.
I agree with that. I mean, that doesn't mean you have to take me to Professor Frost teaching in the spring. The other thing I was going to say is... she's not teaching it in the fall because she's on leave in the fall, but Professor Epperson teaches both critical race theory and education law, which I think are actually both very heavy civil rights e-classes. I'm not sure which one she'll be offering in the spring, but I would definitely keep an eye out for her in the spring. Mm-hmm. Professor Hutchinson has taught both critical race theory and remedies.
Yeah, remedies is a good class.
Remedies is not necessarily a civil rights class, right? Yeah. It really depends on who's teaching it, but the way Professor Hutchinson teaches it tends to be very heavily focused on the civil rights side of it. Other professors might teach a much more sort of contract, common law-y kind of remedies class. So those to me are the sort of the foundational civil rights classes.
Well, we also have employment discrimination, yep. Which Susan Carl teaches in the fall.
Well, I was going to say, then they're all the specific ones, right? Employment discrimination, you know, we've taught, Professor Jones teaches a seminar called Race, Crime, and the Law, which is heavily a civil rights class. You know, I don't think she's teaching it in the fall because she's teaching evidence and crim pro, but she might be teaching it next spring.
We certainly have gender, sexuality in the law classes as well, right?
Feminist jurisprudence. I think within specific sub-pieces of civil rights law, there are a lot of seminars and smaller courses, but those would be the big ones. Yeah, unfortunately, I think Fed course is a foundational civil rights class.
Fortunately, it's a great class. It's a great class.
Jury's still out.
Okay.
I mean, First Amendment is not specifically a civil rights class, but it's certainly a constitutional law, civil liberties class.
Well, we can probably stick around for a minute or two if you guys want to come ask us questions out of earshot of everybody else, but otherwise, good luck with your registration. Godspeed. Thank you for listening at home or wherever you are when you're listening to this podcast.
Come ask us about
Latin. Yeah.